really am so excited to be here with y'all and to be here with this really distinguished panel on congressional oversight. Michaela Carr is the Oversight Staff Director for the U.S. House Committee on Ways and Means, and she leads that subcommittee in all of its investigations dealing with taxes and Medicare and Social Security and all of the other issues that come before Ways and Means. Neil Eggleston is a litigation partner at Kirkland & Ellis. Of particular relevance to today's discussion, he previously was White House counsel in the Obama administration. And back in the 1980s, he also served on the House committee that investigated the Iran-Contra affair. And finally, we've got Michael Bopp. He is a partner at Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. He chairs the firm's Public Policy Practice Group and Congressional Investigations Subgroup. And he previously served as Associate Director of OMB during the Bush administration. And he also, and relevant to today's discussion, he served as Staff Director and Chief Counsel of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, including as well as a number of other investigative capacities on Capitol Hill. We'll start with Michaela, who's going to give an overview of congressional authorities. Then Neil will talk about the White House and administration response to congressional oversight inquiries. And then Michael has some great insights on the developments of executive privilege and insights from the private sector. Michaela, why don't you go ahead and get started.
Thanks, Amanda, and thanks to the Federal Society. Of course, similar disclaimer, the views that I represent are not those of Chairman Brady or the Committee on Ways and Means, but are my own views. So congressional oversight, not mentioned specifically in the Constitution, but there is no question in law or history or policy that it is not a very important and significant aspect of the role of the legislative branch. In no way would Congress be able to legislate effectively and fulfill the roles that are outlined in the United States Constitution without the ability to obtain information about how what they do is being carried out, whether that's by the executive branch, whether that's how those the laws that are passed by Congress are being executed by the executive branch, or how the laws that are being passed by Congress are either being followed or skirted or attempted to skirt by the private sector or pretty much anyone, right? And so I'm going to talk just briefly about the breadth of congressional oversight and then some of the limits. In theory, the breadth is immense, right? Congress can look into anything that it has jurisdiction over. And there is very little that we don't have jurisdiction over. Here at Ways and Means, you know, I kind of like to joke, we have jurisdiction over everything. Either we tax you, and we have jurisdiction over that, or you're tax exempt, and we have jurisdiction over that, right? We have a lot of power to oversee. And all of Congress has that same kind of role. And so what Congress has the power to do is get information. And while it's not specifically mentioned in the Constitution, for a very long time, the very earliest cases that confirm that we have the authority to compel information, with an understanding, of course, that the information that is freely given, that is given voluntarily, will not always be the information that we need, right? You ask a question and someone gives you an answer, they tell you what they want for you to know. Voluntary information is not always going to be the most full series of information, which is why Congress has the power to compel. And so kind of how do we do that, right? We have the power to compel information through document request letters, which really are just polite asks. We have the power to compel information through subpoenas. We have the power to compel testimony through public hearings in front of committees. We have the power to compel testimony through depositions. And short of that, we have the power to obtain information in a variety of ways that fall just short of those compelling authorities, right? So first, we'll just start, a lot of committees start with like a basic letter. We are interested in this information, let us get some information. In today's society, very often that is a first step that is often quickly followed by a subpoena because the response to the letters are not always as fulsome as the committee had hoped. But if you don't take that first step, there is often a criticism that you didn't take that first step. And so a lot of this, as with everything we're going to discuss, is there's the actual limits that exist, and then there's the limits that exist because of political will and the political realities of the situation. Congress has the power to call for briefings and interviews. That's usually done by the staff. The staff can call up the committee anyone under the committee's jurisdiction and ask for information. If you have jurisdiction over HHS, you can call HHS and ask them to come in and brief you. You can call up HHS and ask them for significant information, and they can decline. And if they decline, you have the authority to compel them to come through depositions or through public hearings. And every committee has their own rules that are put forth through the committee at the beginning of each Congress as to what their deposition authority is and what their subpoena authority is. But at this point, every committee does have some subpoena authority to compel once the initial request is usually insufficient for those purposes. The subpoenas, again, are the actual force of compulsion, right? So you can subpoena, the committees can subpoena information, can subpoena documents, and can subpoena depositions. And this is the way that the committees can actually compel people to come in and provide information that they wouldn't otherwise be available. The rules for depositions and for subpoenas are listed in the House rules and vary by committee. But the reality, of course, is also based not only on what the rules are, but what the political appetite is. Does a committee chairman have the authority to subpoena a secretary, a cabinet member? Yes. Does he have the political will to subpoena a cabinet member? Maybe, sometimes. And I think that is something to keep in mind when we're talking about the breadth of congressional investigations and the limits. Depositions can be compelled, and that is something where more recently you've seen an increase in Congress of staff deposition authority. Many committees now have staff deposition authority. This is, again, a situation that varies by committee, whether the staff has the authority to compel these depositions. But in each of these, it's very important to remember that the staff is acting with the power of the chairman, right? This is not a rogue ability for a staff to go out and ask questions that they would want. This is staff acting kind of in lieu of the chairman, a way to compel information that the chairman would have the ability to compel in a public hearing, but behind closed doors. A really valuable tool for congressional investigators to have, either because they're still in the fact-gathering stage of the investigation and they don't necessarily know the answers that they're going to receive, because they want to get information from people who maybe are not the right people to be subject to a public hearing. Maybe for a variety of reasons, somebody has information that Congress needs, but for a variety of reasons should not be the focus of a public hearing. Either they weren't a wrongdoing, there's a reason to protect their privacy, their source. They might be a whistleblower who has information to give but does not want to be labeled as a whistleblower or does not want to risk their career and their reputation, especially in this public and political environment. And then hearings, of course, which I think most people are most familiar with. Congress has the power to compel people to come and testify for hearings and hold hearings. And in the course of oversight and investigations, Congress's ability to hold hearings, I think, is one of their most powerful tools, but one of the least effective. I think everything that I named first is often more effective than the ultimate hearing, which at which point you're limited by, you know, public cameras and a short time frame. And I'll just speak really quickly on limits, which is only things under the committee's jurisdiction, only for a legislative purpose, and only what you have the political appetite for, which I think we'll get into a little bit more.
So thank you, and thanks to all of you for being here, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me. I'm not a natural constituent, actually, of the Federalist Society, but I'm happy to appear and have appeared a few other times at panels and various different events. I'm pleased to be here. So I've been, as you just heard, my first involvement in these issues was when I was deputy chief counsel of the Congressional Investigative Committee that investigated the Iran-Contra affair. And just to remind people, and sort of particularly in light of what's happening today, the events kind of blew up. They had taken place prior to that, but they kind of blew up around Thanksgiving of 1986. And then the committees, special committees, were established in January of 1987. We held televised hearings throughout the summer of 1987. I think for hearings that went on for a while, probably the most watched hearings there have been at least recently. I mean, there have been a few others that were a couple of days that were watched, probably the most watched hearings. We finished probably by mid-August, and we released our report before Thanksgiving in November of 1987, which was quite lengthy and quite sort of well-reviewed. And so we did the entire Iran-Contra investigation in less than a year from the formations of the committee up through the release of the report, and I'm still quite proud of all of that. But in terms of the sort of the issues that Michaela was talking about, particularly the privilege issues, which is I'm going to have a little bit of a theme on those, is and you'll be able to catch the theme pretty quickly, which is in that one, if I'm remembering right, and Jay Stevens is here, probably remember better than I do, the President Reagan actually had decided not to assert privileges. And the result was that we had private individuals asserting Fifth Amendment privilege, but there was not an assertion of executive privilege. In fact, we reviewed, during the course of the investigation, a very few of us reviewed President Reagan's diaries to see if there was anything in the diaries that related to what the issues under investigation had been. But if you remember, there was a sort of a parallel criminal investigation, and in some ways the executive branch's power was at its lowest, really at its lowest ebb, and was not particularly going to be able to make those assertions in face of Judge Walsh, the independent counsel. And when there's a showing of wrongdoing, and there was pretty powerful showing of wrongdoing by people in the executive branch, that essentially the ability to assert those kind of privileges, at least in my view, was pretty much at its lowest ebb. So I was involved in that. I then was in the White House counsel's office for President Clinton. And that was in some ways a similar issue, I think. I got there about 6 months into the administration. By that time, the travel office episode had already taken place and was under investigation. Shortly thereafter, it was learned, I sort of put that in passive voice, that Vince Foster, in his briefcase, had some information that related to Whitewater, which meant that the Whitewater investigation really took off. We did some things internally in the White House that were pretty stupid that resulted in some contacts between the White House counsel's office, frankly, and the Department of Treasury, which made that a pretty fruitful ground for an investigation. And so even though, frankly, at that time, I think both the House and the Senate were in the hands of the Democrats, there was a pretty aggressive investigation done. And once again, and as I look back, I'm particularly surprised, we didn't really assert privileges. I remember, it wasn't in this room, although I can't remember what room it is, but I testified in both the House and the Senate, and there were a long line of us. Mac McClarty, who was the chief of staff, testified. John Podesta, who was the staff secretary, testified. I testified in counsel's office. I think Bernie Nussbaum, who was the White House counsel, testified. And there's one particularly embarrassing picture of all of us standing up with our hands raised as we're being sworn in to all to testify. And looking back, sort of the notion that we let that happen is as I think about it, is kind of surprising to me. But as I say, again, we're a little bit of a low ebb in assertion because we had done some things wrong, and obviously there was some investigations that impacted various things. I had a little role in representing someone in the Bush administration in the investigation into the firing of the U.S. attorneys. And that was a little bit of a mixed bag. I represented somebody who did not have any particular exposure, although I remember getting a letter from Fred Fielding. I was her private counsel. I remember getting a letter from Fred Fielding saying she can go up there and testify, but don't violate the executive privilege. So by that time, I knew Fred, and I called Fred and said, well, you know, I'm like pretty much just a private lawyer here, Fred. Are you going to give me any advice on what that is? And like sort of where are my lines? What can she say and what can't she say? And Fred basically said, good luck, and sent us up there. Actually, I was pleased by this. She testified on the Senate side, and the committee let me sit next to her because they recognized that she wasn't going to be able to make those determinations, and it was not her privilege that she was vindicating. It was the White House's privilege that she was vindicating. And so essentially she and I kind of on the fly decided if there were questions that would run afoul of the executive privilege in the letter she had that she had received. In the Obama administration, in a lot of ways, this was less of an issue for us. It definitely came up from time to time. But, you know, we didn't particularly have scandals. And to the extent that these assertions are at their lowest ebb, and it's easier to have political will for the members of Congress to continue to push and push and push and seek to enforce. That's easiest for Congress if we're at a low ebb. In the Obama administration, we didn't really have scandals, and we didn't have, we didn't have any, but we didn't have any like what we're seeing today, and we didn't have anything like what we saw in the Clinton administration. And the result was that the power dynamic was a little different. Fairly early on, well, actually, let me say one other thing, which is I didn't know President Obama before he hired me to be his White House counsel. I've never asked him this. I assume you all know, you're all sophisticated and been around, but presidents in their last 2 years nearly always lose the House and the Senate. If they haven't lost them both by then, they nearly have always lost them by the last 2 years of their administration. And they nearly always have a scandal in the last 2 years that is pretty significant. And I think the president thought this could happen to him, and he wanted somebody who'd been spending a lot of time thinking about these issues to be his White House counsel. I've sort of always assumed that's why he hired me, because I didn't know him. I had no relationship with him before, a pretty good relationship now. So this enforcement piece, and I think Michael's probably going to continue to talk about it, shortly after I got there, the House Oversight Committee, or whatever it's called now, subpoenaed David Simas, who was our, I think what his exact title was probably matters, and I don't quite remember, but political director. He ran OPSO, and I don't remember what OPSO stood for. But there was a subpoena to him because there was some thought that he might have been violating the Hatch Act. There were no allegations he had violated the Hatch Act. There were no newspaper stories that he had violated the Hatch Act. There was no suggestion he had violated the Hatch Act. And he was an assistant to the president. And frankly, I was prepared to litigate that. I think I would have been at the highest position, and I think I would have won that in court. Congress eventually decided not to seek to enforce it against him. I think I've never talked to him. I don't know if people made a judgment that the same sort of litigation judgment I did, but I would have loved to litigate that one because I think I was on the highest plane of sort of the flip side of what Michaela said, obvious power by Congress to conduct oversight. I completely agree with that. I think in our era, the House did fantastic work, for example, at the VA, which really had problems and benefited enormously from the oversight that was done, in my view. I thought Chairman Chaffetz at the Secret Service did really good work and was quite helpful helpful to the Secret Service in raising issues and forcing them to confront the issues that they had in their culture and the various things. I think there's really good work. I could probably go on and on at really good work that was done. But there is a constraint, which is that Congress can't interfere with the ability of the president to get his job done. And so that's ultimately, I'm sure we'll talk about it more, that's ultimately where this clash comes in. The president has to preserve an ability to get his job done, and Congress cannot interfere with that. By the same token, Congress obviously needs information in order to do his job. But that's basically where this fight, in my view, ends up joining itself over and over and over again. And it's fascinating. And we'll see. I think there's some developments in this administration, and I'm sure we'll continue to talk about some of those. Thanks. Michael.
Thanks, Neil. And I also do thank the Federalist Society for inviting me and for putting on this panel. I think that congressional oversight is, you know, one of the most important and yet least focused on aspects of, obviously, Congress's work. But really, regardless of whether the House and the Senate and the White House are occupied by the same party or different parties, in either case, congressional oversight is critical. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, I think, over the course of the next 40 minutes or 30 minutes. Let me just pick up on a couple of things that Neil was talking about. And by the way, Neil, did you say that the Iran-Contra hearings that were televised were some of the most watched hearings in the modern era? Because I thought you said that, and I'm looking at the audience wondering how many folks in this audience actually watched or really followed the Iran-Contra hearings, or I guess even beyond that, have heard of the Iran-Contra hearings. I did. But in any event, let me pick up on what Neil was talking about in terms of privilege, because I want to, this is something that I know I've spoken to a number of folks in this room about, and we've talked about on other panels, and that is the difference between the two privileges that are espoused, that are part of the executive privilege. There are now two distinct privileges. The first is the presidential communications privilege. The second is what has been, in my view, created by the courts, and that is the deliberative process privilege. And I think the second of those privileges really threatens to eviscerate to a large extent Congress's ability to examine and oversee the executive branch, if it is used to the degree that that at least one court has indicated it could be used. Now, the presidential communications privilege is one that we're all familiar with, and it is one that Neil alluded to. And that is the privilege that requires, that protects documents and information solicited and received by the president or his immediate White House advisors with broad and significant responsibility for investigating and formulating the advice to be given to the president. So it is a narrow circle of people, and it is for a specific reason. It is to protect the ability of those people to provide advice to the president. The deliberative process privilege is something entirely different. The deliberative process privilege basically says that any agency within the government, the decision-making process that any agency in the government goes through to make a decision, that process itself is covered by the executive privilege. I think it's an extraordinary proposition, but unfortunately, it's one that has gotten a little bit of traction. And so the way that the deliberative process has developed, a number of folks in this room can speak to it probably better than I can, because my experience is similar to Neil's, and that is when I was doing investigations up on the Hill, starting in the mid to late 90s and going up through the 2000s, the deliberative process was very rarely invoked. I think now you see it a lot more, and you see it in the guise of agencies saying that, hey, look, we will only give you information after a decision is made. Well, the problem is, after a decision is made, that information is usually a matter of public record. Decisions made by agencies are usually disclosed to the public in some way. But it's the deliberative process often that Congress needs to take a look at in order to make sure that a decision was procedurally rightly arrived at. Now, the deliberative process, the real question here is, where does it come from? Is there really a constitutional basis for it, or is it something that many of us are familiar with in the context of FOIA and the common law, right? I mean, there is a deliberative process exception to FOIA. If you seek documents from the executive branch, that branch or an agency may assert a deliberative process privilege, and you may not be able to get at or have access to documents that relate to the deliberations of the agency before a decision is made. The question is, should Congress also be faced and limited in that same way? Should Congress not have the ability to get at deliberations that an agency goes through before it makes a decision, or should Congress have broader authority? I think, to me, the answer is pretty obvious, that Congress should have more authority than I have if I fire or anyone files a FOIA request to try to get information from the same agency. And yet, this is an issue, and it's a problem. But there are people in this audience that have taken steps that have confronted this issue and have found ways to in some ways get around it. Maybe we'll talk about that later. But in the interest of time, let me raise one other issue that I think is a fascinating one and related one in the area of congressional investigations. Now, it's related because, take the situation where a congressional committee wants to get access to either email traffic or instant messaging, communications between federal government officials. If those officials and if that agency, for example, asserts the deliberative process, what can that congressional committee do? Well, that congressional committee might decide, hey, let me go to the internet service provider or some other provider of communications to the executive branch. We've seen some of this happening. I don't know how successful congressional committees have been, but the real problem here is you run into the Stored Communications Act. Now, the Stored Communications Act prescribes limits to the ability of internet service providers to produce information, produce communications by individuals that they provide the service to. But there are exceptions, and Congress wrote exceptions, as one might expect, into the law, and the main exception that is relevant here is that an internet service provider may disclose content when that provider is served with a valid search warrant from a governmental entity. Well, great. Congress is obviously a governmental entity, right? In this case, no, wrong. Congress did not write itself into this statute, and therefore, the Stored Communications Act, by if you look at it, by its plain terms, seems to not create an exception for congressional committees. Now, why would Congress not write an exception broad enough so that its committees could get this type of information from internet service providers? Well, I don't know the answer to that. And I'm not sure who does, but there are arguments, I know, that Congress can make and has made, one of which is, well, Congress can, if Congress, if a statute, for a statute to be read as limiting Congress's authority in this way, the statute has to be explicitly limit Congress's authority, and this statute doesn't. It's just by omission that this statute does not include Congress in the exception. This could be a very powerful tool in order for Congress to get information that it can't otherwise get or is having trouble getting from the executive branch. As I said, I know it's been used. Congressional committees have been trying to use it. But there is this issue, and it's an issue that needs to be thought about and overcome and or resolved in some way. Let me turn it back to Amanda. I know we're limited on time.
Thanks so much to all three of you for those insights. That was a really fascinating discussion of those issues. I have a couple of questions, but I'm confident this audience is full of them, so I will try to turn it over pretty quickly to you guys. But one question that was raised in the email that went out to all of you that I'd like to just get your thoughts on very quickly, I'd like to talk about the politicization of oversight. People today are lamenting that oversight has become very partisan and political. We have a panel of folks here who have been doing oversight or involved in this world for quite a while. What changes have y'all seen over time? What's caused that? And are there ways to improve oversight by reducing the partisanship of it? And
I think that a lot of initial oversight questions are not inherently political. I'd probably say that most of the time, initial oversight questions, there you go, how's that? Initial oversight questions are probably not inherently political. Very quickly, once the question is asked, most people who work in the legislative branch would say, yeah, I would like the answer to that question. That's a good question. And then within days, weeks, months, moments, people take sides, right? I mean, and some of the examples that Neil gave of some recent oversight, both the Secret Service investigation that was done jointly by Chaffetz and Mr. Cummings on the Oversight Committee, and the VA, I mean, those were bipartisan issues, even though there was significant criticism to be given, and there were significant ways in which both sides could retreat to their corners. You know, the Democrats were very quickly to say, well, if we just gave them more money, and the Republicans were like, bah, they always spend too much money. You know, so I mean, there were some easy places to retreat to their corners, but there were legitimate issues. But I think that we very quickly retreat to our corners, and we should do everything in our power to work across the aisle on oversight issues, because at the end of the day, I think the Article I initiative has the perfect title, because we will lose. We absolutely will lose the authority to do robust congressional oversight if we do not band together and say, no, actually, executive branch, actually, you need to answer these questions. I mean, the idea that President Reagan waived privilege, which, of course, you know, is something that we all know as lore, but it's, you know, really reassuring to hear. It would never happen. It wouldn't happen now. It wouldn't have happened under Obama's administration. It wouldn't have happened under Clinton's administration. It wouldn't have happened under Bush's administration. So we just kind of go down that path. I don't know if you disagree, but I think I always say each administration is the least transparent ever. And I have yet to be proven wrong.
So I think that's probably right, and I may be partially to blame for it in the Obama administration, so I'm not shirking that. I frankly regarded one of my jobs as protecting the institution, not just for my president, but for future presidents, including the current president. With, you know, I don't agree with him on almost anything, but I have enormous respect for the institution and the necessity for it to have the power to do its work. And so when I was working, I just didn't think only about President Obama. I thought about who his successor might be and the successor after that. And I frankly think, what's happened, look, they're always political because that's the nature of the beast. And it's Washington, and we fight every fight through that lens. And I don't think there's anything you can do to not fight through that lens. I do think that there are things that happen that end up to be sort of big fights, and I always wonder why we had them. I remember in the VA one, and I don't know, can't remember if either one of you was involved, so I'll be a little careful here, but they wanted like personnel files of all these people in the VA, and I was like, no. I mean, if they explain to us, there are good people working in the VA, and if they explain to us there's some reason that they need it, okay, we'll talk about it, but I'm just not going to turn over all these personnel files of all these people who just get up every day and do the work on behalf of the veterans of the company, and and so we ended up in these big fights, and I thought to myself, why are they fighting with this over sort of this issue? And sometimes I think it's because, you know, you ask a question, you think you're entitled to the answer, and by God, you're not going to give up. And I think you're not entitled, and by God, I'm not going to give up. Although I would say that at least during my years, you know, I tried not to assert privilege early, deliberative process or anything, and I remember Chairman Chavis called me up once and said, Neil, I don't understand why you don't assert privilege over this stuff. I said, Jason, the problem is once I assert privilege, it's kind of hard to negotiate. And like, I would rather work with you to see if I can protect what I really care about, but give you, because most of what you want, I don't really care about. But there's a piece of it I really have to protect, and let's accommodate it. And as soon as I assert privilege over it, it's really hard for me then to turn it over, because now I've acknowledged I'm turning over stuff I've claimed was privilege, and that puts me in a very odd place. So I said, look, we don't do that until the end, until we can't accommodate any longer, but I'd much rather see if I can get you what you want. You're going to have to give a little ground. We end up giving more ground, I think. But I think that's sort of the way I like it. We may come back to it. I think the House's decision to litigate the Fast and Furious case, so far it's been not a great decision. Obviously, there are people who decided that it was important to get a ruling on that. I don't know what's going to happen in the D.C. Circuit. I don't even know if it's still in the D.C. Circuit. But I think there are areas where relations between the branches are better off just fighting between the two of them and sort of having power struggles, and each of them have their weapons and not resort to the courts, because I don't think this is an area where clear lines is actually a pretty good idea. So I think we just ought to keep fighting, we meaning with my executive branch hat on, not my Iran-Contra branch hat, that the two branches just ought to keep tussling with each other over this and sort of getting an answer through the courts, I think is actually a mistake.
Yeah, just another word. Amanda, your question was whether investigations are more politicized now than there used to be. And look, I think the answer to that question is it is so personality driven. And, you know, you can't look at a committee like the Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations or, you know, traditional investigative committee, Energy and Commerce, or Hoger in the House, and say, all right, well, this is how we expect it to act in this Congress. Because if, you know, Dan Burton is the chair versus Daryl Issa versus Jason Chaffetz versus Trey Gowdy versus Elijah Cummings, you're going to get a massively different committee. And I don't think that congressional investigations are more politicized now. I think it just depends on the chair and ranking. I think Susan Collins and Claire McCaskill did a fantastic job together on drug pricing. I think that Rob Portman and Claire McCaskill, and I'm not pitching McCaskill here, but did a great job in the Senate on at PSI on a couple of different investigations, the most notably Backpage. House side, similarly, although I agree, Jason Chaffetz, Elijah Cummings have worked together on some investigations, but on a lot of investigations, they just don't. And Jeb Hensarling and Maxine Waters are very unlikely to ever work together hand in hand on an investigation. So it's personality driven. You know, Carl Levin, really one of the grandfathers or fathers of modern congressional investigation, all his investigations were bipartisan. He worked across the aisle, and he supported the investigations of the Republicans, whether they were ranking or chair. Even if sort of, by his nature, he might not have chosen to do that investigation himself. And that's I wish there were more of that, but there still is some. And so I don't think that it's, I'm not despondent about, politicization being a lot more rampant now than it used to be.
Neil, you made a comment that each side has its weapons and we should keep our fights internal to the government, or at least between our two branches, and not reach out to the courts to settle those problems. So in that case, I think that an article that is very timely, it was in The Hill the other day, entitled Time for Congress to Enhance Contempt Authority. If you think that we should each use our weapons, should Congress revive its inherent contempt authority? Right now, according to this article, Chairman Nunes is drafting a resolution to bring inherent contempt charges against FBI Director Wray and DAG Rod Rosenstein. And again, interesting that it's a Republican Congress versus a Republican administration in that regard. What do you think about inherent contempt?
So
maybe explain a little about what inherent contempt is.
I followed that a little bit, and we used to think about it. It's not clear to me that they don't already have some inherent contempt power. I'm not sure that they actually need a new statute, but typically the way the criminal contempt process works is that there's a vote by the committee, vote by the full House, and that's referred to the U.S. Attorney's Office for prosecution. Usually a party doesn't go into contempt unless the Department of Justice has told them, there's a whole process, told them your assertion of privilege is valid. And so the Department of Justice has already determined the assertion of privilege is valid, and essentially the U.S. Attorney can't prosecute them, because at least that Department of Justice has made that determination, and the U.S. Attorney is not allowed to make some separate determination that he or she thinks that that's different if sort of the powers that be of justice, because nobody really goes into contempt if they're a government official unless the Department of Justice tells them that that assertion of privilege is appropriate. So that's kind of the way the process works. And I've not really thought that much about this, but I think that that assertion, I think that that determination by OLC or the Attorney General would apply even to a subsequent U.S. attorney. It wouldn't be fair for someone to rely on a determination by the Attorney General that the assertion of privilege is appropriate, have a new administration, and then have a new U.S. attorney say, well, I don't agree with that. That would be pretty unfair to our, sort of public officials. It's not entirely clear to me how the inherent contempt power would work, because the reason that we go through this is there has to be some punishment, right? The point of this is has to be some punishment, unless you're going to have the sergeant at arms go arrest somebody and put them in we were talking earlier, probably the worst punishment would be to be put in some of the rooms where these committees do their depositions. That would really be quite a painful punishment, I think, if you were confined to some of those locations. So I don't know. I think one of the issues, and frankly one of the reasons that contempt tends not to end up happening all that often, is first through this process of accommodation. We don't want anybody to go into contempt, and so there's a massive effort. There was, at least when I was there, a massive effort to try to accommodate. But second, the process just really takes forever, and by that time, typically and appropriately, I think the Congress has usually gone on to other things and other issues and figured out other ways to get the information they need. So I would not advance this. I don't think this is appropriate.
Michael or Michaela, opposing views?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think there's a potential role for inherent contempt. And it may be a limited role, and you're right. And to some extent, it's an anachronistic idea of asking the sergeant at arms to go out and seize somebody and bring that person back, either to testify or to be imprisoned somewhere. Although it's possible that you could imprison somebody within the D.C. police facilities. But the thing about, I mean, there's sort of two reasons why inherent contempt is certainly at this point worth thinking about and is being thought about. Number one, as Neil mentioned, criminal contempt just takes too long. Look at Fast and Furious, for example, as a combination, I guess, of criminal and civil, but it's, you know, we're 5 years into Fast and Furious now, and some of the documents haven't been produced yet. And, it's too late, right? It takes too long. And second, as Neil also mentioned, there is this problem of if you have a contempt citation, a criminal contempt citation against an executive branch official, the executive branch does not believe that official should be held in contempt, the contempt citation will never be acted on. And therefore, it becomes an ineffective tool by Congress to try to force or enforce its prerogatives. Inherent contempt is within the control of Congress. And, you know, you could see it being used in, for example, limited circumstances, and one being, for example, if somebody doesn't appear at a hearing or a deposition, you could conceivably have an order issued by the Speaker or the President of the Senate to have the Sergeant-at-Arms or the Capitol Police go out, get that person, bring them in. Without having, you know, an official or a formal trial before the bar of the House or the Senate, which, you know, that's the part that seems a little anachronistic. But it at least gives Congress the potential ability to enforce its own subpoenas when the other mechanisms aren't working in all cases.
Could I just have one comment about that? Yeah. I don't know about any, well, I guess you're mostly congressional people, so maybe this doesn't horrify you. But the notion that committee chairs could order people in the streets around the country to be arrested and dragged into the Congress, that sends chills down my spine. So I don't know if that's where this is headed, but that would be just a little out there.
But it would have to be an action of the Speaker. It would have to be an action of the Speaker or the President of the Senate. It couldn't just be ordered by a committee chair, at least under the precedent such as it exists, and I understand it.
Yeah, I have to defend Article 1. I just have to. So inherent contempt exists, and it hasn't been used in a really long time. And when it was last used, I think, based on my recollection, although I haven't researched it recently, we're talking way back in the Teapot Dome scandal, and they didn't actually lock him up, although we do have a jail in the house, we do, and I would like to use it more. But it's not up to me. But where they locked him up was the Willard Hotel. So no tears here, right? I mean, and it was well established that they could lock them up either as for punitive punishment or coercion, right? I will lock you up until you give me the information I want. Everybody acknowledged that it couldn't last beyond the existing Congress, right? Because the Congress is a new thing, every Congress. So it exists. I think there's an argument to be made that it should be used. And here's why I think that. Because criminal contempt has largely failed, right? And that's why this is so interesting to me, because when we look at the recent times when criminal contempt has made news, and these are stories that you're going to hear about, when Harriet Myers was held in contempt, when Josh Bolton was held in contempt, when Eric Holder was held in contempt, when Lois Lerner was held in contempt, notice those are bipartisan administrations where people acted in such a way that the United States Congress, led by a party of the opposing side, held the administrative official in contempt. In each of those four instances, which are the most famous in our recent memory, the United States Attorney decided not to present it to the grand jury. But the statute that I think was passed in 1935, I don't really remember, says the U.S. Attorney shall present to the grand jury. It doesn't say may, it doesn't say if they feel like it, it doesn't say if we previously told them that a Fifth Amendment privilege was appropriate or if executive privilege was appropriate, it says shall. And for any of us who practiced in real life before we came to Congress, you can indict a ham sandwich, right? I mean, that's just kind of a thing. So shall present to a grand jury. And if the grand jury decides in its eminent wisdom, this is a political circus, get out of here. Get out of here. Eric Holder was acting in his position as Attorney General to the President Obama, and you Republicans are on a political witch hunt. No, we're not going to indict him. Fine. But the statute says the U.S. attorney shall present to the grand jury. And they just flat out refuse to. So when Congress writes a law and the executive branch says, don't care, then maybe we need to start exploring other options and exert Article I powers.
Thank you, Michaela. Agreed. Let's go ahead and open up the floor for questions. I feel like this audience probably has a lot of them. There's a microphone over here. Please use it. Really? I know all of you, a lot of you in this room, and you always have a lot to say about this topic.
Hi there. My question's for Ms. Carr. So you talked about a few of the resources available to... Oh, sorry, can you hear me now? Oh, great, okay. So you spoke about a few of the resources for oversight committees, such as hearings, depositions, et cetera. In this new technological age, when we have the internet at our disposal, a lot more technology at our disposal, how can oversight committees or subcommittees use technology to their advantage in order to get oversight work done?
That's an excellent question. I think, you know, something that I kind of jumped to is, you know, letters and depositions and subpoenas, but I think oversight starts with knowledge, right? How do we get smart on issues? How do we know? How does congressional staff or members or chairman, how do they know this is something that we need to look into, whether it's, you know, offshore accounts or energy companies taking advantage, allegedly, of tax shelters, or, you know, whatever the issue is, the only way we know about it is if it's brought to our attention. And I think one of the ways the congressional staff need to be kind of constantly working, right, there's never a break, we're always on, is to use that vast amount of technology to become smarter, become more aware, read what's going on in your boss's districts, read what's going on in your committee districts, or your committee, your areas of jurisdiction. I think as far as kind of, what's the word when you're not in person? Using like a FaceTime or something for depositions and technology, I would really kind of hesitate to kind of move towards that direction. I think in-person interviews, in-person hearings, in-person depositions are really, really valuable tools, and I would resist a little bit trying to do that via technology, but that doesn't help, or that doesn't hurt the investigator from traveling, going out, FaceTime, talk technology, Twitter. I mean, using all of these ways to communicate with people that otherwise wouldn't have a voice to Congress. Now with technology, more people have their voice, and so we should encourage them to use that.
I knew Elise would come through.
Michael mentioned that a lot of oversight depends on the member of Congress who's in charge. Also, I heard Michaela commenting about the importance of bipartisan oversight. Do you have suggestions about how we could encourage more bipartisan oversight, what we could do with congressional leaders or otherwise to try to reinforce those norms for fact-based bipartisan oversight?
Well, I know, first I would say some of the things that you're doing and that Senator Levin is doing in terms of providing training and a forum for thinking about and talking about congressional investigations, probably more than anything else I can think of, seems to me the right approach. Part of it is, I think, you're not going to change politics, right? And we're not going to be able to affect who has a certificate of election. But what we can do is, you know, talk to people and to some extent educate about how important congressional oversight is and the sorts of things that Congress has been able and congressional committees have been able to accomplish on a bipartisan basis through oversight. PSI is a great, Permanent Subcommittee on Investigations is a great example. It's one of the only, I think it's the only subcommittee that has no legislative jurisdiction, yet it does some of the best, most hard-hitting oversight, and that oversight has led to a significant number of, you know, important legislative accomplishments. And, you know, that could not have been, I don't believe that could have been, I welcome your thoughts, but I don't believe that could have been accomplished without the bipartisan support that that subcommittee is famous for. If you don't have the bipartisan support, very hard to do a long-range, methodical investigation, which can lead to, you can establish the foundation, a factual foundation on which you can build legislation. Now, how do you encourage that other committees? Maybe by showing, as you're doing and as we're doing here today, showing the successes that can be built on good oversight.
Yeah, the only thing I would add to training is to remember that we're all just human people, right? And so you're going to call the people that you know and are comfortable with. And so the more we get out of our safe little partisan sides and make friends with staff on the other side, make friends with staff in other committees, then if something comes up, you're like, you know what? They might be... This might be a thing, but if you have someone to call and talk that through, then you have a better chance of it gaining traction if you have good relationships with the people across the aisle. If you have a great idea but nobody to talk to, it's never going to happen, right? You, at a human level, pick up the phone and call, hey, this came across my desk. Do you think we could work on this and make some progress?
I'll chime in there, too. Thanks for all the plugs for PSI, Michael, my current employer. One of the things that, or two of the things, I guess, that we do that are a little bit unique that fosters bipartisanship, one, like Michaela said, we have a lot of staff interaction. Our offices are actually joined with each other, so we're in each other's office space all the time, talking to each other. We try to do happy hours together and actually be friends with each other. And that is very conducive to having open conversations about what we are working on. And the second thing that is helpful, I think in a number of ways, is that we don't announce our investigations publicly until we have something to show for them, until we get to the report stage or the hearing stage. When you have less press attention on the initial stages of an investigation, it's easier to be collaborative and then come out with a joint product rather than having press try to shove you into your separate corners. So I'll just commend those two practices, and Elise has been a terrific mentor to all PSI staff and talking to us about working on our bipartisan relationships, and we're very grateful for that. Other questions?
So going back to contempt, first part of the question is are there any punishments directly issued by Congress as a result of those votes? And if so, how do you reconcile that with the fact or the provision of the Constitution limiting punishment to removal from office for executive branch officials? Yeah, so how do you reconcile the fact if there are punishments issued directly by Congress with the provision limiting punishment of executive branch officials to removal from office, impeachment?
I think I got it. The punishment is, by Congress's view, is contempt, right? The reality is that the legislative branch relies on the executive branch to enforce the laws, right? So there's a couple relevant provisions to when this would come up, right? Like 18 U.S.C. 1001 is don't lie to Congress. I don't care if you took an oath. I don't care if I've sworn you in. When I'm sitting and taking a transcribed interview, I'm representing my chairman, and you can't lie to me. So 18 U.S.C. 1001 says don't lie to Congress. That's a criminal offense. 18 means jail time, right? In this instance, it's up to 5 years and I forget. Lots. Anyway, money. So a punishment. But Congress doesn't pass hand the punishment down. That is then relied upon for the executive branch to say, you have violated 18 U.S.C. 1001 or 1503, which is obstructing a congressional investigation. So they have these punishments, but they're not handed out by Congress. We rely on the executive branch, which I think is why it's so interesting right now in a unified government, where we've seen in the past when someone has been held in contempt or been held in contempt by a vote of the House and confirmed by the Speaker of the House that someone did either lie to Congress or otherwise withhold information without the authority to do so in violation of 18 U.S.C. 1503, that is passed over to the Department of Justice, which shall, right, but they haven't. So then we rely on the Department of Justice to actually administer that punishment.
I saw some hands back here.
So this was sort of touched on by some of the other questions and responses, particularly the one about technology. But certain areas of the administrative branch, as they've grown in complexity, like think for the intelligence community, do you think Congress has been able to keep pace in sort of terms of staff and resources to conduct effective oversight? And what are some areas that you think committees and whatnot need more resources and support in terms of conducting effective oversight?
I think that one of the areas that Congress would really benefit from is enhancing their ability to review mass quantities of information. Right. I grew up in the private sector. Went to a law firm after law school where we had an entire staff full of people that you got a big document production, and I never saw it because staff would load it into a computer for me, and then I would be able to search for relevant documents and flag things. And Congress, I think, is a little bit at the whim of the administration in this sense. The administration will, if you ask for documents, even if the administration pretends to comply, they will just, give you boxes of documents instead of sending them electronically, right? So the administration has the ability to have them electronically because they're keeping them electronically, and they could send them to you in a disk, but they don't. They print them out and then throw them down the stairs and then stack them up in boxes. Then stack them up in boxes and then hand them to you. And so then Congress is really, kind of at the whim of time and hours and human resources, whereas I think one of the things that we could do better at is keeping up to speed with modern day litigation technology that exists for the exact purpose of reviewing vast quantities of information.
We had very tiny little stairs at the White House, so we it would block the whole thing if we threw them down our stairs.
I think we're running up on time, so maybe one more question. Savannah, I saw your hand up back there.
What do you think is the most common or perhaps concerning misconception about congressional oversight on the part of the general public, and how can those of us who work in oversight seek to correct it?
Well, I think, I'll start, but others probably have a similar view. I think that it's touched on by the politicization, point, which is the ones, unfortunately, and I was on the other side of some of these PSI cases when I was in private practice, and they just did fantastic work, but there wasn't a political bent to, they spent a lot of time on offshore tax havens. They did fantastic work on offshore tax havens, but it wasn't a Democrat political issue. I think that but except for the day the report comes out, the public didn't really hear much about that. The ones they hear about are the ones that are highly partisan. And we're in a country where we're all divided by partisan. And so the people who, like that the investigation is scoring points, regardless of which party is doing it, like it, and the ones that doesn't thinks it's a witch hunt. And then now we're hearing all this about, over-criminalization of the process. Look, as you can tell, I've been doing this since the 80s, and I've been hearing that since the 80s. If Alan Dershowitz thinks he's got a new idea, he's like, and I'm sure it predated when I started doing this. This is not a new thought that the process has become overly criminalized. So I think I just think that's an issue. I completely agree that bipartisanship would be quite useful. But in fairness, people make decisions about what's in the party's interest and their interest, and it's not always. Look, you wouldn't have thought that Benghazi was going to, the way it went, that it was going to end up being bipartisan. It sort of went the way you'd expect it to go. And people on one side thought it was a great investigation, really important, and the other people on the other side thought it was entirely to keep Secretary Clinton from being president. And there's nothing anybody could have really done, I think. That's just a reality, and we're just kind of stuck with it. And I just think that's kind of where we are, and probably worse because we're so divided, and which is, I believe, unfortunate in itself.
The one thing I would add to that, I agree 100%, but short of a Benghazi situation, the one piece of advice would be, regardless of what side you're on, you have to do really, really good work. You have to be right. The facts have to be right, and you can't be sloppy, and you can't, because first of all, our names aren't on this. Nobody knows my name. My name's not on any of my reports.
but my chairman's name is. And I can't put him in a position where he's saying something that either is factually inaccurate or is later proven to be factually inaccurate. And that's the best way that you can kind of do really good work, because you should be doing it anyway, but also protect the institution's reputation and your boss's reputation for really caring about the right answer.
And I'd just say, I actually think the public's perception of congressional investigations is pretty accurate. I think because one thing about members of Congress and particularly chairs of committees, they're pretty good at getting publicity. And, you know, I think that congressional investigations do get publicized, some more than others. Usually there's, you know, some rough justice in the amount of publicity an investigation gets relative to the the subject matter and the skill in which the investigation was executed. So I'm pretty, you know, I think congressional investigations kind of get the play that they deserve. Maybe they deserve a little bit more, but that the public follows them, and you know, the public wants Congress to do these investigations and to root out corruption. And you know, I think that's one of the reasons why we're here.
Thank you so much again to the panel and to Federalist Society and Article One. We're really grateful for the time here.
Yes, thank you very much. Can you hear me? Okay. Amanda, Michaela, Neil, and Michael, thank you very much for your thoughts today. It was an excellent conversation. I have a feeling for Article One, this is sort of a opening conversation for congressional oversight. And thank you all for joining us. A couple things to report about Article One. In this year, we've done 50 of these events across the country. We've done 10 here in Washington, D.C., and we plan to continue to do so next year. We've established a podcast called Necessary and Proper, which I encourage you to check out on iTunes and Google Play. We are looking next year to establish a confidential blog for congressional staffers to provide their front row perspective about what's going on in Congress. And we look forward to having conversations just like this one next year, but we'd also like your input. So please give it to us at fedsoc.org/articlei. Again, thank you to the panel. Thank you to the committee for allowing us to use this beautiful room, and have a great day.